阿弥陀仏、南無阿弥陀仏、南無阿弥陀仏。So as I said, my family's been a Buddhist priest for 14 generations. My father was the first one who didn't become the resident priest of a temple and instead became a scholar, a professor, and I followed in his footsteps. But there was a point in which I had to make a decision, actually. When I went to live in Ryokuin, Nande Osho said to me, Mark, why don't you become a Zen monk? And, you know, and I thought about it for about 5 minutes. it was very interesting because my family knew I was thinking about this, and I didn't really understand at that time the gravity of my going forth with my own life to carry on the family tradition. So my grandmother wrote to me in Japanese saying, my grandfather this, my father that. And I didn't really understand even at that time, but I much more appreciate now. And one of the reasons why I went into academia is because I myself, I've moved over 20 times due to my father's work and studies and work and so on and so forth, and my own, then, you know, my own studies. And so I don't really have a hometown. When people say, Mark, you know, where do you come from? I say, the Pure Land. As a result, partially of that experience, and maybe just something, you know, inherent, I really enjoy and thrive in diverse environments. I'd rather meet people who are unlike me rather than meet people who are like me already. So it's really great for me to be able to come here to the Greater Boston Zen Center and just to have this opportunity with all of you who... You're all diverse, but then also it's also a different setting for me than my usual setting. It's just a wonderful experience. What soothing music. Music from the Pure Land. I actually forgot what I was going to say. No problem. It's just going to take me a second here. Oh, yes, now I remember. All right. Yeah, so, but I thought, well, the great challenge is going to be, because I'm a second-generation academic, I also know the pitfalls of my field. It's going to be hard to maintain a spiritual practice and a spiritual, to realize what I consider to be essential for my own existence in that environment. But I was fortunate to have some role models, among whom I count my father as an important one, as well as some other great philosophers and others that continue to inspire me to this day. And I never dreamt, actually. It's beyond my expectations, beyond my dreams, the experiences that I've been able to have. I've been so, so fortunate. Especially when I look back upon the fact that when I really faced my early crisis, when I was a young man, it was really a life or death struggle for me. So it's a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit, of a miracle that I'm alive at all. And for me to be able to experience the things I've been able to experience is just really such a gift and so amazing. And I count among those great, great experiences, students I've had an opportunity to work with who've taught me so much. And recently, there's two students who come to mind. One is Elizabeth, and she's just finishing her PhD in philosophy, which combines Western philosophy, including feminist philosophy, and Japanese philosophy that's heavily influenced by Buddhism. And ironically, I'm way too busy to try to lead a sangha locally in Eugene. So, but especially since my parents moved there during their retirement 7 years ago, we want to have some gathering, so we have like a once a month Dharma gathering. And just my family, just four of us, my parents, my wife, and myself. And we just invite a few people that I think are genuinely interested in, and aren't going to take a lot of my time. So Elizabeth is one of those. And she's just finishing. She's just finishing her dissertation. And congratulations to her. She just got a job at McDaniel College in Maryland, which is just wonderful, right? And it's especially moving to me because, you know, she expressed her appreciation for being part of our sangha as well as her studies. And I never really thought about her as like my student or something. If she wanted to do an interdisciplinary dissertation with somebody else, I mean, that's perfectly fine with me. But I ended up being her main advisor, and her understanding of Buddhism is really, you know, I really admire what she has come to realize. And I have another student named Ian, who was also in the philosophy department, and he's half Japanese and half you know, non-Japanese American, and he wanted to study race and philosophy, but he eventually started coming to study with me more and studying Buddhism and philosophy, and I invited him also to come and be a part of our sangha. And Ian sent me an email a few months ago saying, you know, I've decided to leave the philosophy program at the University of Oregon, and I really appreciate everything you've done for me, and I hope you're not disappointed or upset that I'm leaving. And I immediately replied, no, not at all. I'm happy if you're happy with the decision and path that you're taking. So I knew that he was leaving at like the end of March, so at our monthly Dharma gathering, we had a celebration for both Ian and Elizabeth. And I said, I'm so happy that both of you are taking the path of life, each of you, which is best for you. And it's been a great honor and privilege to get to know both of you. And I wish for, and I cannot imagine otherwise, that each of you will continue, your lives will continue to unfold in such rich and wonderful ways. So, Shinran Shonin, Shonin means kind of sage. Sometimes it's translated as saint, but that's the wrong translation. It means like great sage. So that's what we call our founding teacher, who lived at the same time as Dogen, the founder of the Soto tradition. So Shinran and Dogen were contemporaries, but almost certainly they never met. They might have, but unlikely. But it doesn't really matter, right? The most widely read work in which we find the teachings of Shinran Shonin is a work called the Tannisho. My father's translated. That's the translation I use. And in section 1, Shinran states, the primal vow does not discriminate between good and evil, young and old. And there's other statements. Somebody mentioned the Kyogyo Shinsho, which is this major philosophical work, in which he says, Amida's primal vow does not distinguish between good and evil, young and old, man and woman, orthodox, heterodox. No distinctions. Of course, in the oneness of the Dharma, there are no distinctions. And I think in that moment, I received that feeling from the Dharma and sharing it with Elizabeth and Ian and everyone. As a professor, you want to see your student complete their degree and succeed professionally, and then it's a feather in my cap. And I can't deny that at some level, you know, something like that might be there, but it was never my, unlike some of my colleagues, it was never my interest to produce people who carried my intellectual influence. Of course, I'm happy when people acknowledge me, you know, and I see that my ideas matter. But really, that's so secondary to me, not because I don't have vanity, because I'm a very vain person, but because I'm more interested in people. And that what really nourishes me and what really rewards me is that deep human connection, that deep sentient connection between one being and another. And for that, that's not about the exterior labels. It's not about the exterior attainments. It's about whether I feel this person is truly walking the path of life that they choose and is an expression of their deepest self, their deepest reality. One is not better than the other. Elizabeth is not the success and Ian the failure, not in any sense, or vice versa. Ian writes in an essay that he wrote for me, "Many parts of Buddhism, having encountered it relatively late in my philosophical exposure, have brought back loving memories of my initial exposure to many of my favorite figures in philosophy, particularly Socrates. I found Buddhist thought to be such a nutritious ground upon which an individual can grow unhindered by dogmatism, which has always kept me away from so much Western religion, at least my experience of it. At its core, I think that Buddhism provides a holistic account of how an individual can face hardship with courage, find solace in life's simplest moments, release from solipsistic tendencies, and generally live a happier life." An outcast viewed by others to be a threat, like Socrates in the Apology, Shinran's entrusting himself in Buddhist practice to boundless compassion is also reminiscent of Socrates' second sailing discussed in the Phaedo. Quote, "On each occasion I put down as hypothesis whatever account I judge to be mightiest, and whatever seems to me to be constant with this, I put down as being true, both cause and about all the rest, while what isn't, I put down as not true." In other words, Socrates commits himself fully to a particular hypothesis, which by its very nature may be untrue, and follows it through to its logical end. And I believe that this spirit is directly echoed in the Tannisho when Shinran says, in regard to entrusting himself to the primal vow, which is the same as the bodhisattva vow, to bring all beings to awakening with oneself, which is just another way of expressing the unfolding flow of the oneness of reality. I really do not know whether the saying of the name Namo Amida Butsu may be the cause of my birth or realization of the Pure Land of Oneness, or the act that shall condemn me to hell. But I have nothing to regret, even if I should have been deceived by my dear teacher and chanting Namo Amida Butsu fall into hell. The reason is that if I were capable of realizing Buddhahood by other religious practices and yet fell into hell for saying the name, I might have dire regrets for having been deceived. But since I am absolutely incapable of perfecting any religious practice whatsoever, hell is my only home." This quotation for me encapsulates a lot of what I meant when I said that Buddhism allows one to escape solipsistic tendencies by entrusting himself purely to the primal vow, the unfolding of oneness. Shinran implies that he has freed himself from his personal salvation, personal desire for salvation, and instead given himself over to the oneness that he and Amida, his deepest, truest reality, share. He is saying that, emptied and free of all artificial content, of all artificial ideas, heaven and hell begin to lose their oppositional natures and reveal themselves to to be nothing more than two sides of the same coin, ultimately joined in the cosmic dance of the deep oneness of reality. I initially found the idea of entrusting myself to the other power of boundless compassion to be somewhat cowardly, a way perhaps to pass on responsibility for bad results onto things other than ourselves. But I've since found that it was actually that way of thinking about entrusting that was providing the element of cowardice. Entrusting a particular way to produce happiness within the context of an always uncertain end is courageous, like Socrates proudly facing death in the Crito, knowing that he had faithfully lived the best way he knew how. It is foolish to claim that I know where to find happiness. I don't. But I do know that if I put faith in myself to cultivate a particular way of inhabiting the world and method of living, then I can at least be happy knowing that I have given myself the opportunities that I saw as most genuinely representing happiness. Today, as I look forward to my future, there is only fog. There is a surprisingly hopeful horizon for me, having encountered Buddhism. Whereas I once saw myself heading unblinkingly towards a goal that I was unsure of, I now feel rather free in my undirectedness, and I'm able to cultivate meaning in small experiences because I do not have to consider them in reference to some previously determined goal, like getting a PhD. Works like Thich Nhat Hanh's Being Peace and Shinran's Tannisho have really impacted my ability to release myself from the attachments of desirous, goal-oriented thinking and focus on living a more contented life by acknowledging the subtle beauty of life in its many variegated manifestations. Although I have no idea what the future holds for me, I am sincerely grateful for the perspective that Buddhism has provided me, because I know that given a certain disposition, I can find happiness over the course of my entire journey, divorced from attachment to what perceived good might come at the end of it. You know, so to me, this is real philosophizing. This is not about getting a degree. This is not about winning the argument. But it's deeply reflecting on one's life with sources that of wisdom that have come to one as gifts. And when I think about someone like Ian, who's to say he isn't an even greater philosopher for having decided to not complete his professional academic journey. And I have tremendous respect and admiration for his path. I have tremendous admiration and respect for her path, Elizabeth's path. But the one who taught me this was none other than the founding teacher of our tradition, Shinran. At the end of his great work, the Kyoyo Shinsho, there's an afterword. And in the afterword, he describes his historical circumstances. His teacher, Honen, and he were part of a new movement of Pure Land Buddhism of chanting the name Namu Amida Butsu without having to refer to ecclesiastical authority. And it became a huge popular movement. But religions were only sanctioned by the state. You had to be sanctioned by the emperor to be officially a sect in medieval Japan in the 12th and 13th centuries. So as part of the power struggle among different Buddhist movements, all the officially recognized sects went to the emperor and said, "This is no good. This is an outlaw movement." And so eventually it was outlawed. And Shinran and his teacher Honen were exiled into the countryside where they wouldn't have access to the same kind of audience and to the centers of power. But after the emperor and his court and the leaders of the other Buddhist sects felt things had died down a bit. They pardoned Honen and Shinran, but Honen was very ill and he died shortly thereafter. Shinran had been exiled to live among the farmers and the peasants, the fishermen. But he found the experience living among the people much more real and down to earth than living among the intellectual class and the aristocrats. And so when he was pardoned, he refused to return. He refused to return to the capital. And by this time, he was married. Buddhist priests were not supposed to be married, but he was openly married to a woman named Eshinni. But Eshinni was not this woman's given name. Eshinni is a Buddhist name. And any name that ends with ni indicates an ordained woman, because it's the suffix for all nuns. All nuns' names in Japan and in China end with ni. So she was also ordained, and they both wore robes, and they taught, they had a ministry together, and they taught side by side. But he was not officially sanctioned for this. And so he writes, through these historical circumstances, this has resulted in what I am now. I'm neither monk nor layman. That's what he writes. So he's tracing the history of it, but it's a much bigger statement than that. He's saying in the way of the great Mahayana, there are no monks or lay people because we're all one. But there's a deeper realization being articulated here, which is, but my true reality is that I'm a foolish being filled with blind passion. And yet the farmers and peasants and fishermen have embraced me as if I am one of their brothers. I'm one of their own, even respecting me as a teacher when I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy to be called a monk. I'm not worthy even to be called a good layman. So the real meaning of that statement, hiso ni arazu, zoku ni arazu, is I, this foolish being, Shinran, this foolish being filled with blind passion, am not worthy to be a monk or a layman, but precisely because of that, precisely because I'm illuminated precisely as this foolish being filled with blind passion and embraced and dissolved into the ocean of light. Therefore, I can step forward and walk this path of life, knowing that I don't need to be anyone else, that I am myself, that I'm truly realizing my life in the flow of the great oneness of reality. And this is what each of us wants for ourselves. I want, you want, we want to feel, this is the life I want. My life. I don't want somebody else's life. This is my life. The gift from the universe. And when we feel that within ourselves, we want others to feel the same way. That's why it's so secondary. The external outcome is so secondary. That's why I was so happy. Elizabeth said, I want to write this dissertation about a new model of the understanding of the self, combining Hegel and Japanese philosophy and the feminist philosophy of Simone de Beauvoir. I'm thinking, but what field is that in? And is there a job for this? But I thought, okay, so I do have to watch out for the practicality of her dissertation topic. But it's her story. And when I read her application statement to her jobs, I realized this is who she is. And it's beautiful. Not because it's profound, although it is, but it's because it's her. And Ian's essay is beautiful. Not because it's sophisticated and profound, although it is, because it's Him. So, my greatest gift as a teacher is when I feel the student who comes before me feeling, yes, this is my life. And that's the meaning of, this is the meaning of Namu Amida Butsu, and this is the meaning of sitting only. My father was a pioneer in the field of Buddhist studies. And also in Buddhism in America. And so he's a very well-respected person. And he wanted to become a scholar. Partially because he suffered so much at the hands of the dominant culture because he was discriminated against being Japanese, especially being thrown into the internment camps as a little boy, having everything taken away and having to live behind barbed wire for I don't know how many years, 3 or 4 years. He was angry. And he had something to say. He wanted to say, this is my heritage. This is who I am. And that's part of the reason why he became a scholar. And when my grandparents and their children came out of the camps, they had nothing. My father said, you know, I was so ashamed when I had to go to school because all the other kids had new clothes and I just had worn out clothing that didn't fit properly, and shoes and old shoes. And I just remember picking peas in the summer, and during the hot summer, just to eke out an existence as a young man. So I admire him so much for having accomplished so much in his life. And he was very proud of what he accomplished, and rightly so. But then just like everybody else, he had to face retirement. And then he had to face, you know, not being Professor Unno. And then he had to face not being able to remember all the complicated things that he knew. My father's undergraduate major, he went to college. When he first went to college, he says, you know, Mark, it didn't feel like going to college because I went to junior college because that's all, you know, my family could afford. So he went to Marysville Junior College, which is in Marysville, California, which is this tiny, tiny town. I don't know what the population is. This is probably like 2,000 people, right, back in the day. He says, did feel like college. Why? Because it was in the same building as the high school. But after 2 years, he was able to transfer out to go to University of California, Berkeley. And what did he major in? He majored in English literature. Why? I don't know if he was conscious of it at that time, but I think, you know, subconsciously, his drive was, well, I'm going to be able to talk as good as anybody else. I'm going to be able to talk better than you, right? And even well into his 70s, and you know, he could recite Chaucer in Middle English. So funny. He can't do it anymore. He can't remember Chaucer anymore. He doesn't remember, you know, any Sanskrit. He can't parse classical Japanese grammar. So we have our monthly family Dharma gatherings, right? And we do the same chanting, Jusege, and I lead the chanting. And then we all go before the Buddha altar and we all bow. And we all turn around and face each other just like here. And I turn to my father. I say, hey, Dad. You have a Dharma message for us? Sometimes he says, nope. But sometimes he speaks, right? One time I said, Dad, you have a Dharma message for us? It's good to be alive. He's a very, very articulate speaker. My father's very, very articulate speaker. But he can't formulate complex thoughts anymore. But he's fully present. But that's the one Dharma talk I'll never forget. It just means I fully receive the gift of the Dharma, which is the gift of my life. But at his age, okay, it's not just the gift of life. At his age, it's the gift of life and death. And that's what human existence truly is. I receive this gift of life and death now. Yes. In the great, great unfolding of the arc of the universe, regardless of whether you believe in reincarnation or not, you're only born and die as you, with your name today, one time. In the billions and billions and billions of years of the life of the universe, one time. And when we realize that, we are moved. We are led, we are moved by the great arc of the universe to truly receive. Human species. Not very smart. This is my conclusion about our species. Human species. Not very smart. Global warming. Resource depletion. Come on now. Fracking isn't the new revolution. It's the last gasp of petroleum. Hello. Messing everything up. Gotta be kidding, right? So we have brilliant stars, right? The Buddha, Jesus, you know, Gandhi. But they're the exception that proves the rule. The rule is foolish being. But within our limitations, as foolish beings, we have our place. We're all related. We're all interlocking pieces. Great physicist David Bohm said the reason we have the principle of non-locality is because of the implicate order. That means is we have paired phenomena in the universe. One object in the universe can only affect another object in the universe at the speed of light because the chain of cause and effect cannot happen faster than the speed of light because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. But scientists have discovered, oh, Mr. Electron over here spins clockwise and Milky Way and Ms. Electron over here and Andromeda spins counterclockwise, and they're paired phenomena. They say there's a deeper level in which everything is linked that's beyond the naked eye. This is the Buddhist reality of oneness. Everything's part and parcel. In fact, even this language, part and parcel, just something imposed artificially with use of human language. We let go of the language and everything is just unfolding. The universe is being born again as a whole in every second, right? This is the Zen understanding. This is the Taoist, this is the Tao understanding. That the universe wasn't born 43 billion years ago. The universe is born all of it in every second. And what that means is in the great, great unfolding of the arc of the universe, if somehow I wasn't messed up, then nothing else could be the way it is. The beauty of the sunset. is inseparable from the wiping of my ass. Mark, that's so brilliant. You should be a poet. It's just, it's the miracle. It's what I've come to call the miracle of life and death. And when we realize it, it's just to live. It's just the sheer act of living. It's just so amazing. Just so amazing. We're realizing something that's impossible. That I should be alive is just impossible. And yet it's here. And yet it has to be realized for it to come alive in my own awareness, in my own life. And that's what each of us wants, just to be who we are. No one else. This is the simultaneous realization of foolish being and boundless compassion. And in Dogen's language, delusion and awakening of deluded sentient being and Buddha nature. Andy, can you read your poem, Renegade Pinky? So, Andy just published his collection of poems. And I think it beautifully captures a sense of foolish being dancing in the light of boundless compassion.
Renegade Pinky. I have a renegade pinky and a heavy left foot. I can no longer type and my mom was kaput. See, there's part of my brain that's neurotransmitter load, the part that helps me move, helps me get up and go. Now my head can't tell my feet what to do. It's been overthrown in a gray matter coup. My mind's on fire, but my body don't move, and I may look stiff, but I still got my groove. And I'm no first air when I'm cutting the rug. I got my own boogie I call the brain bug. My mama might swing like a toilet seat, but can't touch my tango for two left feet. I don't pen these words for your sympathy, I just thought you should know what's gotten into me. I may be ill, but I solemnly vow to live out my days in the here and now. So I hope you understand, as I write to decree. So I hope you understand that as of today, I have a new approach to extra S's and A's. It is what it is, I write to decree. From here on out, fuck the backspace key.
I mean, that's just so great. That's just so great. And that poem would not have come into being without Andy being all of Andy. That's just Namu Amida Butsu. That's just Namu Amida Butsu. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. Such a beautiful thing.
No more midamut. No more midamut.
So thank you very much for the morning session.